Today, in the second lecture, the texts I'm going to talk about set for this second week, Freud's paper, Further Remarks on the Neuropsychoses of Defense, which refers to earlier work, and the novella by Sheridan Le Fanu, the mid-19th century, late 19th century Anglo-Irish writer, which called Carmilla, which is a vampire narrative, one of the more sophisticated vampire narratives that come out of the 19th century Gothic tradition. And I'm putting these two together in relation to the theme of seduction. Freud's paper is one of a series of three papers which form part of what's called his seduction theory, which is written in the years 1895-6, published in 6. There's a group, there's three of them. And the novella is about the seduction of a young woman by a vampire who is herself a young woman. And it's a very long, drawn-out courtship and seduction. It's not like a vampiric, violent vampiric rape in which a vampire just violently seizes against their will a victim, a passive or traumatized victim. It's about a seduction, about trying to win somebody over. So it's extremely interesting as a text from a general psychoanalytic point of view, but it is also particularly interesting, I think, in relationship to the whole debate within psychoanalysis about theories of seduction. And in particular, Freud looked back from the position of the French psychoanalyst Jean Laplanche, whom we will be talking about later on this term, who constructs a retrospective and critical take on Freud, on the other side of Freud, as it were. And this novella resonates with, anticipates some of the issues that will come up theoretically. Okay. Further Remarks, as I've said, is one of a group of three seduction theory papers in which Freud has moved on from the text that you looked at in week one. Those were the essay co-authored with Joseph Breuer on the mechanism, the psychical mechanism of hysteria, of hysterical symptoms, and the little case studies from the studies on hysteria, the book that Breuer and Freud put together, in particular the case studies of Katerina and Miss Lucy R., and a third case study from another text, an unpublished text of Freud called Project for Scientific Psychology, The Case of Emma. So Katerina, Miss Lucy R., and Emma, you've talked about as cases. And in particular, they're cases of hysteria, which is explained in terms of the framework of a trauma theory, in which behind the production of hysterical symptoms lies a traumatic experience. Now, Freud's pretty open as to what this traumatic experience might be in those early papers from 1893 through to 1895, from last week. Occasionally, in the studies on hysteria, there's something sexual, and in the Emma case, there was as well. But it's only with the seduction theory papers that the positing of a very, very early infantile experience of sexual abuse, we would call it today, is a necessary precondition for the production of all hysterical symptoms. And indeed, in the seduction theory papers, all forms of psychopathology for Freud. So that would include obsessional neurosis and paranoia as well. These are psychical conditions, and behind the production of these different kinds of symptoms, there is a very, very early experience that is both infantile and sexual. And Freud is pushed towards that conclusion progressively and almost against his, certainly against his expectations and almost against his will, because it creates a whole series of problems. Before he commits himself fully to this, to the necessity for traumatic infantile seduction, he's nevertheless found that his model of the production of a traumatic symptom is complicating itself. And we saw that in the move from the 93 paper with Breuer to Katerina to Miss Lucia, the a complex time structure it gradually forces itself on Freud, and he finds himself not just discussing a simple cause and effect, isolate the historical symptom, get the patient to free associate, or initially under hypnosis, he used to do it, then he abandoned hypnosis, and he finds the strange clinical experience that very often, as the patient free associates around the moment when the symptom first appeared, the symptom will intensify and then gradually fade. And Freud called this the moment when the symptom joins in the conversation between the analyst and the patient. And that initially appeared to confirm Freud's assumption that if the symptom intensifies and then fades, he's discovered the causal moment. The moment, and at this point, the moment when the symptom appears is identified as the moment that caused the symptom. Now, gradually he discovers that that's too simple, and that behind the moment in which the symptom first appears, which the patient more easily, not always, but more tends more easily to be able to work their way back to, there's another moment, a precondition. Okay. Now, in the work of Charcot, who was his great teacher, studying with whom in Paris, he changes his whole intellectual career from neurology, a study of brain and the physical nervous system, to psychology, due to Charcot. For Charcot, who described traumatic material, there was always a precondition, and that precondition was inherited. It was a hereditary constitution, a hysterical constitution. And this was the predominant, as I said last week, the predominant medical paradigm in the 19th century. Something was inherited in the family line, and that was being activated or reactivated, that constitution, by a series of events that happened at a later point. And they may well be the events that that first precipitated the symptom out for the first time, but it was only by reactivating this inherited constitution. Now, Freud moves away from that assumption and gradually finds that assumption untenable. And the whole idea of an inherited constitution that is lying there just waiting to be reactivated by what Charcot calls agent provocateur, like the terrorist figures in late 19th century Europe who are planting bombs or performing political assassinations, hoping to reactivate a discontented population into revolutionary activity. It never worked politically, and the model doesn't work psychically either, Freud comes to discover. But what is this X that he wants to posit that's a precondition? And the material produced by his patients leads him progressively further and further into their past and into their childhood past. And that's what Freud hadn't expected. Okay, go back to puberty, but all this pre-puberty material that's coming up. With his seduction theory papers, he reaches the point in which the replacement for Charcot's inherited hysterical constitution or obsessional constitution is replaced by these very, very early infantile experiences. And it's only because the later experience reactivates them on the other side of puberty that the hysterical symptoms can be explained. And that's Freud's move to his seduction theory model. his claims in the earlier text from last week are quite modest in a way. On the one hand, it's a big discovery, how to get rid of hysterical symptoms or obsessional symptoms by unearthing certain kinds of associations and memories. But what he realizes is that this doesn't cure the condition of hysteria. And he admits this as much at the end of the 1893 paper with Breuer that you looked at last week. He says that if you get the patient to reenact, not just to remember in a cerebral way, but to reenact the experience and the emotions associated with it, and I'm reading from the final page of that paper, it brings to an end the operative force of the idea, which was not abreacted, not discharged in the first instance, by allowing its strangulated affect to find a way out through speech. So the emphasis on speech and on the way in which an emotion that hasn't been expressed but is attached to forgotten or repressed early memories is brought into consciousness and released. That is crucial for the efficacy of the cure. But the cure is limited. And he says quite clearly, it is of course true that we do not cure hysteria insofar as it is a matter of disposition. We can do nothing against the recurrence of symptoms and hypnoid states. Okay, so he can dissolve away a symptom, but another hysterical attack will happen. More symptoms will be produced. So the title of his paper is The Mechanism of Hysterical Phenomena. He can understand the mechanism and intervene in it, but he can't stop them from continually occurring. Okay, this has brought us no nearer to an understanding only of the mechanism of hysterical symptoms and not of the internal causes of hysteria. We have no more than touched upon the etiology, that is to say, the causal sequence of hysteria, and in fact have been able to throw light only on its acquired forms. So the clinical problem is the patient keeps coming back with more symptoms to be dissolved by Herr Dr. Freud, but the underlying condition is not cured. Freud feels he's got to that mysterious X, that precondition, in his discovery of the infantile experiences of a sexual kind that his patients gradually lead him to. And that then becomes the basis for his elaboration of his seduction theory in the 1896 papers, one of which we are looking at this week. So he sets that up for us in the opening pages of the paper. And in particular, he foregrounds the question of defense, the ego's defense against certain intolerable, exciting, but intolerable, maybe forbidden, maybe transgressive or taboo experiences. And for Freud, one of the explanatory problems was, why should a particular experience produce hysteria in one person, obsessional neurosis in another, paranoia in another? In other words, you can isolate or begin to identify in a certain kind of infantile sexual experience, but something else as well, something that belongs to a later moment, the moment when that experience is reactivated. And initially Freud thinks this must take place on the other side of puberty. And see what the stance the ego takes towards that experience, the mechanisms it calls on to defend itself against that experience, to wish it away, to get rid of it in some way. And he gives us three different mechanisms in the 1896 paper we're looking at. First of all, for hysteria, a combination of repression, banishing the idea from consciousness, and the conversion of the affect, the intense feelings attached to that, into bodily symptoms that are associated in some way with the experience itself. So we saw with Miss Lucy R, her nasal problems and her fixation. She can't smell, except she's haunted and dogged by one or two particular smells. the smell of the burnt pudding or the smell of the cigar smoke, which is acts as a kind of fixated signal in her mind of a congealed experience that she's banished from consciousness. And it's what its trace and its representative in consciousness is this fixated smell that she whenever she's upset she smells it, and she doesn't know why. That's conversion, hysterical conversion into bodily symptoms, and specific to hysteria. With obsessional neurosis, that I'm not going to spend much time on, Freud says that it's the ego's stance in reaction to these early experiences is one of self-reproach, self-criticism, beating yourself up over the fact that you were sexually involved in certain kinds of experiences, that you were active, that you took pleasure in them, and the obsessional fictions that are generated are transformations of those self-reproaches. The third mechanism is one associated with paranoia. Freud still uses, and as the editor points out, the notions of defense being coterminous with the idea of repression. Later Freud, in theory of paranoia as a psychosis, specifies a mechanism of projection onto another person. These are not my feelings, they are the feelings of this other person who is persecuting me. So the paranoid mechanism is that of projection, and Freud does produce that word in the course of this text for the first time in a published paper. And I've chosen this paper for us to look at this week because he gives us this very, very detailed a case of Frau P, paranoid woman, a lot of clinical material there, more full of things to be attended to, more even than Freud draws our attention to, a clinical material that can speak to us in a way almost independently of the sense Freud makes of it. So we've got those three possibilities, and it's the only case study that Freud published in the context of the seduction theory. So it's particularly interesting for that reason. The first section of the paper that I want to just draw your attention to is picking up the idea that I talked about in the lecture last week of what Strachey calls, in his translation, deferred action. Freud's German term is Nachträglichkeit, which I talked about last week. The English, a new English translation suggested by Jean Laplanche, afterwardsness. And the word afterwardsness in English sounds odd at first, but it does exactly replicate the two syllables, or the three syllables in Freud's German term, nach, after, träglich, from the verb träger, to bear or to carry, as in bearing a grudge about something that happened in the past, and the k-e-i-t ending, which turns it into an abstract noun. And the equivalent in English is N-E-S-S. So we have afterwardsness, which captures both the forward movement in time and the backward movement in time. The problem with the Strachey's translation in the standard edition, deferred action, is it's a one-way movement from the past to the future, whereas this double temporal movement in the temporality of trauma and the trauma cases that Freud is gradually feeling his way to understanding from as we follow him from text to text. Now, in the Emma case from the project, I'll just read out a couple of sentences. This is the paper you looked at last week. In the case last week, where he's talking about pathological defense of repression in hysteria. And he gives us the story of Emma, or Emma's narrative of going into the shop as a teenager, seeing two young men whispering together, feeling that they were laughing at her, and running out in a panic. And from there on, having this permanent long-term symptom, which is a phobia. She can't go into shops alone. And there's a disproportion between that as an intense reaction that becomes a permanent one. And just two young men, she thinks laughing at her. Possibly she doesn't know laughing at her clothes, the way she's dressed. So there's this unintelligibility about the symptom. It's not an appropriate response to the moment when it first appeared. And in particular, it's puzzling because we're told that Emma can is okay if she's accompanied by somebody, even a child. So that fact alone tells us something, that it's not to do with looking at her clothes. As Freud points out, she's now a young woman. She could choose to dress in any way. She doesn't have to dress in the way her mother dresses her. She could choose her own clothes. So it doesn't really seem to make sense to explain it in that kind of way. So there's this gap within the narrative. And only gradually in the course of treatment with Freud, she produces this memory that as an 8-year-old, she went into a shop to buy some sweets, and the shopkeeper molested her, felt her genitals through her clothes. And then she goes back a second time, and then is filled with horror and guilt, and feels uncomfortable thereafter. She has a guilty feeling, she says to Freud, thereafter. But she thinks that it wasn't in her mind. She hasn't thought about this early experience for years. So it wasn't in her mind when she saw the two young men, or when she ran out for the first time, panic-stricken, from the department store, and thereafter had developed her phobia. That this early experience she was not conscious of. So Freud then tries to understand how the earlier experience is a precondition for this intense overreaction. It's a repeated scenario, or mise-en-scène, to use a theatre term, in which she's in a shop by herself with a male figure, and the male figure appears to be reacting to her in some way, and that it's the repetition of that that scene, if you like, in which the Freud's argument is, you'll recall, that first of all, a sexual excitation that was produced in the first moment is experienced consciously in the second moment. It's reactivated and experienced consciously. Only this time, she's a post-puberty subject, and so she responds in a very different way from the way she would have responded as an 8-year-old. One needs to say at this point that Freud is still working with a common sense, traditional understanding that sexuality begins at puberty, and that the pre-puberty child is therefore asexual and incapable of having a sexual response. Though he is also, in another part of his work, gradually coming aware that that's less and less plausible, and that certain forms of childhood eroticism are possible. But at the moment he's seeing it as sexuality starts at puberty, and therefore she responds as a fully sexual, a sexually mature person to the memory, and it has an effect. She runs away in fear that the seduction might be repeated, which is different from her reaction as a child. And Freud attempts to conceptualize this by saying that what's at stake here is something that's specific to sexual experience. That the sexual release that she experiences in the second moment, when the phobia develops, is the emergence into consciousness for the first time of the delayed effects of the first experience. This is linked, he says, and I'm quoting, to the memory of the assault. But it is highly noteworthy that the sexual release was not linked to the assault when this was first experienced. Here we have the case of a memory arousing an affect which it did not arouse as an experience, because in the meantime the change brought about in puberty had made possible a different understanding of what was remembered. Okay, so a different understanding. She can now understand what all that was about. And he says, this is typical of repression and hysteria. We invariably find that a memory is repressed, which has only become a trauma by deferred action, and that's the Strachey translation, by deferred action. The cause of this state of things is the retardation of puberty compared with the rest of the individual's development. Okay. So there's a gap between our non-sexual and our sexual development, as it were, a disconnect between them. And that creates a space in Freud's thought, a space in which this strange effect of deferred action or of afterwardsness takes place. The belated intensities then produce a symptom in reaction to what is a non-sexual event. Okay, so that's the argument he makes in the Emma case in 1895. He's now moved to the point where that early experience is a precondition. The symptom would not have been produced. There wouldn't have been this hysterical overreaction if the second experience hadn't reactivated, rhymed with, reworked the earlier experience. And it's in that second moment that repression takes place. The subject realizes what it is, the feelings that they're going through, what it is they experienced, and blocks it out. And I just want to draw your attention to the long footnote in the further remarks paper for week two, in which he goes over this idea a second time. That this earliest infantile experience replaces Charcot's idea of an inherited constitution as the necessary precondition for the production of hysterical or psychopathological symptoms in general at a later point. Okay, this is another restatement of this logic of traumatic time or of traumatic temporality. He says, if the sexual experience occurs during the period of sexual immaturity, and the memory of it is aroused during or after maturity, then the memory will have a far stronger excitatory effect than the experience did at the time it happened. And this is because, in the meantime, puberty has immensely increased the capacity of the sexual apparatus for reaction. An inverted relationship of this sort between real experience and memory seems to contain the psychological precondition for the occurrence of a repression. I'll quote that again. An inverted relation between real experience and memory. That is to say, something is experienced more intensely as a memory, but wasn't experienced in that way when it first happened. Sexual life, he says, affords, through the retardation of pubertal maturity compared with the other psychical functions, the only possibility that occurs for this inversion of relative effectiveness. And then the italicized statement, the traumas of childhood operate in a deferred fashion as though they were fresh experiences, but they do so unconsciously. So something is being relived, and though it's happened before, it's as if it is being relived for the first time. That's the paradox about this kind of this repetition, so that it's not just an ordinary memory of a kind we might have. I have a memory now in the present of that event back there, and I can look back at it across the distance and maybe catch one or two characteristics of it. Rather, something is happening again, but it's happening for the first time as far as my consciousness is concerned. So I feel that it's happening now. It's a real event, even though it's a repetition of something else. And Freud struggles with the paradoxes of this strange kind of experience, because it undoes the common sense notion of memory. Memory is my memory now of that event then. Whereas what's happening with Emma and with other subjects in this experience, who are having this experience, is something remembers me. A scene remembers me, or I'm being remembered. It's not something that I'm consciously choosing to do. Suddenly something replays itself and I am conscripted into it, right? A scene happens again, and I seem to be in the scene, but it's not my scene because I don't have any memories of it. It's happening afresh. It's real. And this experience there are analogies with this kind of experience. One of the most obvious ones is dreaming, and you'll find that next term when we come to look at dream theory, that the dreamer in the dream is experiencing it as if it were a real event happening. The dreamer doesn't experience the dream in terms of memories that are being cobbled together to create the dream. But this is interpolated, conscripted into this event which seems to be happening, and so wakes up screaming or whatever it is dreamers often enough can do, or wakes up feeling happy maybe, but wakes up with the sense that they're still in the dream as a real event. So there's that strange virtual repetition and virtual existence of an event, which is both happening for a first and a second time, as it were, and that's Freud's. It's a conceptual problem Freud struggles with theoretically through his entire career, finding different solutions for it, but solutions that are never quite. He's never quite satisfied, so it keeps repeating. It produces a sort of repetition at the level of theory, this strange kind of lived repetition at the level of pathological experience. So that's. I just wanted to make that connection back to the Emma case, and I'll now move on to the case of Miss Frau P, the paranoid lady. Now, the case of Frau P is particularly interesting. It's a kind of sad case, and in some ways a failed case for Freud, because though he was able to clear up a lot of her paranoid symptoms, they kept. And he, at one point, he thought he had actually managed to cure her, because he did get back to very, very early childhood memories. Her case got worse. Her condition got worse. And she ended up in a mental institution for a number of years, and then mysteriously came out, was better, had another child, and was happy for the next 12 to 15 years, only on condition that she avoided all her family and her relatives, and had nothing to do with either her husband's relatives or her brother's relatives. And when their financial fortunes collapsed and they had to be supported by these very relatives, her paranoia came back massively, and sadly she entered an institution and died of pneumonia within a very short space of time. So it was quite clear that she had a provisional cure, so long as she didn't have anything to do with her family, which suggests that it was very provisional. So it's a case of Freud struggling with stuff that he only partly understands, and making some advances, and then just being being at a loss, really. However, it is an interesting case. So she's 32 years old. She has a child of two. Her parents, he says, were not neurotic, but her brother and her sister are, to my knowledge, like her, neurotic, though we're not told in what way. She was healthy and capable until 6 months after the birth of her child, and gradually she develops a series of symptoms. And her symptomology is quite interesting. She has an aversion to her husband's brothers and sisters, complained that the neighbours in the small town in which she lived were behaving differently towards her from how they did before, and were rude and inconsiderate. And by degrees, these complaints, he says, increase in intensity, but they get rather vaguer. She thought that people had something against her, but she didn't know what it was, and that she was absolutely clear that they had ceased to respect her and were out to slight her, but again, she didn't know why they were doing that. She also complained that she was being watched, and that people were reading her thoughts and knew everything that was going on in her house. And that sense of transparency before a hostile other is, again a classic paranoid symptom. Then a very, very, very specific and very interesting set of symptoms. One afternoon, she suddenly had the idea she was being watched while she was undressing in the evening. From that time on, she took the most precautionary measures when getting undressed, and a very characteristic of obsessional neurosis, a series of immobilizing and paralyzing precautions against often unspecifiable fears. She got into bed in the dark and did not begin to take off her clothes till she was under the bedclothes. She avoided all contact with other people, ate poorly, and was very depressed. And she's sent into a hydropathic establishment. I don't know if we still have them, but you're supposed to have lots of hot baths and electric treatments of various kinds. Nevertheless, new symptoms appear. They increase in strength. And I think a very telling little detail, she was alone one day with her housemaid, and she suddenly had this sensation in her lower abdomen, and thought to herself that the girl had at that moment an improper idea. So she has a sensation in her abdomen, but the girl has a sexual idea. So I think one can see, in a very crude way, a mechanism of projection taking place. This is not my idea. This is the idea of the other person. This sensation grew more frequent during the summer and became almost continual. We are told she felt her genitals, quote, as one feels a heavy hand. That's her phrase. Whose hand, one might wonder. Then she began to see images which horrified her. Hallucinations of naked women, especially the lower part of a woman's abdomen with pubic hair, and occasionally the male genitals as well. The image of the abdomen with hair and the physical sensation in her own abdomen usually occurred together. The images became very tormenting, for they happened regularly when she was in the company of a woman, and it made her think that she was seeing the woman in an indecent state of nakedness, but that simultaneously the woman was having the same picture of her. So this is double gaze. At the same time as these visual hallucinations, she began to be pestered by voices which she did not recognize and which she could not account for. And again, hearing voices is a classic paranoid symptom. But they're often saying trivial things like, that's Frau P, there she goes, where's she going to? Every one of her movements and actions were commented on, and at times she heard threats and reproaches. And she always heard these, or they were at their worst, when she was in company or in the street. For that reason, she refused to go out. Eating disgusted her, and her health deteriorated. One other interesting symptom is that she's a highly intelligent woman. He feels that she's concealing from him certain delusions that would help to interpret her hallucinations. And a very unusual repeated symptom that she makes repeated appointments to see her brother, who lives in the neighbourhood, in order to confide something important to him. But when she arrives, she never tells him anything. But she keeps making these appointments over and over again. And she never speaks about her hallucinations. And she closes up and gets more and more silent about the things that are tormenting her. Now, Freud says he applies the methods that he and Breuer had worked out in the studies on hysteria by getting her to free associate and to produce the thoughts that come into her mind, even if they don't make sense. And she doesn't understand where they come from. She often feels that they come from someone else. But Freud is working on the hypothesis that, that what has caused these paranoid symptoms is a form of defense and of repression. And both the hallucinated images and the persecutory voices. And he notes that the image of a lower part of a woman's abdomen always coincides with the physical sensation in her own body, though she can have that sensation without the image. And she sees some, when she's in a hydropathic establishment, she sees some naked women in the baths. And she produces this new theme, the theme of shame. She told me that she had felt ashamed for these women. She herself had been ashamed to be seen naked for as long as she could remember. Since I was obliged to regard the shame as something obsessional, I concluded, in accordance with the mechanisms of defence, that an experience must have been repressed here, about which she had not felt ashamed, and which in its repetition she now feels ashamed. So he asks her to think back to associations and memories to do with the feeling of shame. She promptly produced a series of scenes going back from her 17th to her 8th year in which she had felt ashamed of being naked in her bath in front of her mother, her sister, the doctor. But the series ended in a scene at the age of 6 in which she was undressing in the nursery before going to bed without feeling any shame, in front of her brother who was there. On my questioning her, it transpired that scenes like this had occurred often, that the brother and sister had been for years in the habit of showing themselves to one another naked before going to bed. I now understood the meaning of her sudden idea that she was being watched as she was going to bed. It was an unaltered piece of the old memory which involved self-reproach, and she was now making up for the shame which she admitted to feel as a child. So she's repeating these experiences and having an adult response to her, to them, by feeling ashamed. Freud then adds another interesting experience that throws some light on her symptoms. A visit from her sister-in-law, who in the course of a conversation let fall the words, quote, "If anything of that sort happens to me, I treat it in a light vein. If anything of that sort happens to me, I treat it in a light vein." At first, we're told that she accepted this statement without as unproblematic. Then after her sister-in-law had left, she feels that it was an implicit reproach to her, that she, Frau P., was in the habit of taking serious things lightly, and she immediately felt she was the victim of a general slander. When I questioned her as to what made her feel justified in applying the words to herself, she answered it was the tone of voice in which her sister-in-law had spoken that made her feel that it was referring to her. He says, I now obliged her to remember what her sister-in-law had been saying before the remark that she now complained of. And it emerged that the sister-in-law had related how, in her parents' home, there had been, quote, all sorts of difficulties with her brothers, unquote. All sorts of difficulties with her brothers. And then she had added her wise comment, quote, in every family all sorts of things happen that one would like to draw a veil over. But if anything of that kind happens to me, I take it lightly. And Freud makes the obvious point that she's upset not by that one sentence, but by the material about brothers and troubles in families to do with sisters and brothers. And that's upsets her, because it's bringing, likely to bring to consciousness her early memories, of which she is now distressed and ashamed about, of this scene with her brother in the nursery. Though I think at this point Freud misses something, because it seems striking to me that the sister-in-law is in effect transmitting a message to her. In that sense, the paranoid is not wrong, but it's a message that is kind of saying, look, I understand what happened. You know, it's cool, right? We had similar problems in my family, and the insinuation is almost that she herself has had a similar experience. If that sort of thing happens to me, I take it lightly. Don't get upset about it. And the implication is, that one might draw from it, is that the brother has told his wife, her sister-in-law, something of what they might have experienced and why his sister is so distressed. And the sister-in-law is trying to say to her, it's okay. It's okay. Take it lightly. To the exact opposite of what she's saying. She takes it as a reproach that she's taking serious things lightly. Of course, it depends on what the term sister-in-law means in this context. Is she her brother's wife or her husband's sister? But I think due to no feelings about her husband are reported. All her feelings that are reported are about her brother. So I take it that it's more likely to be the sister-in-law who is the wife of her brother. And her brother has said to her something of what might have happened. And the sister-in-law is just trying to say, look, it's okay, it's okay. Take it lightly. Don't get too upset about it. It happens in lots of families. It even happened to me. I took it lightly. Freud doesn't pick up on that. And I think he doesn't pick on that up on that because there is another dimension to her repeated appointments to see her brother, and when she arrives she can't say anything. Freud asks her about that, about why she is making these appointments and then has nothing to tell him. Her explanation was that she had thought that if she could only look at him, he would be bound to understand her sufferings, since he knew the cause of them. Now, I think what we've got there to take into one of those turns of phrase, like the turns of phrase in the Miss Lucy R case, apparently casual phrase. Remember, Lucy R is at the deathbed of the woman whose children she is the governess of, and on their deathbed the dying mother says, I want you to take my place with the children, I want you to take the mother's place. And in the context of all the other things that Miss Lysiar has told Freud, Freud hears it as saying something else. He's listening with what later psychoanalysts call the third ear. And Freud says to her, I think you want to take the mother's place with the father as well, not just with the children. In other words, you're in love with your employer. It's quite a leap, quite a bold leap, interpretive leap that he makes, and identifies the situation the governess is in as being a kind of Jane Eyre situation, if you like. And she said, yes, I think you're right. I've been trying to push that out of my mind ever since. So that phrase, taking the mother's place with, first appears in relation to the children, is then reoriented in Freud's interpretation, and says that's a formula. The mother, whom we're told has a relationship to her, the governess's mother, is in a sense the mother figure who says, I'm dying, you can take my place, right? In a sense, it's a kind of female Oedipal wish come true, you know. I'm vacating the place, you can take it, you can have the children, and you can have daddy, okay? and Freud hears that implication in what she's saying, but he doesn't hear the implication, I think, in this idea of looking at and being looked at. That you're looking at somebody who returns their gaze, and it's a sexual look that you're both giving and receiving. And Freud tells us that, in fact, they had been involved in a sexual relationship for some years, involving more than just looking. But the phrase that I want to draw attention to here is that explains and doesn't explain why she keeps making appointments with her brother. She says, if I just wanted to look at him, I thought if I could only just look at him. And that phrase takes us back to that primal scene, if you like, right? In which the desire for the brother is reactivated. And she, well, her way of explaining it is, you know, he knows what this is about, and I want to talk to him. But she also wants to look at him again in the way she had looked at him in the past. There is a reactivated sexual desire there as well. Okay, I won't say any more about that case, except I want to pick on that phrase that echoes through the different descriptions at different moments. It's there again with the housemaid, it's there with the women at the baths, the looking, the sexual gaze, and you feel a sensation in your own private parts, and then you attribute it to the other. Okay. So I think that a sexualized return gaze is at the heart of this case, and it may have something to do with why Freud never quite manages to stop the endless production of paranoid symptoms. He can dissolve individual symptoms, but he hasn't got to the underlying condition, even though he has got back to this infantile scene. I don't think he's heard it. He hasn't heard the crucial element of looking at and being looked at in return, and the relation to the brother, which is repeating itself in the present. Okay. Okay, so much for our P. Okay, a few final words about as a way into thinking about Carmilla and its relation to the question of seduction. A point I want to make about seduction is just the meaning of the word. There's been some kind of debate and criticism of Freud because he talks about his seduction theory, and in the light of contemporary attitudes to child sexual abuse, some people have said, well, seduction makes it sound okay, and what we're talking about is abuse. Now, Freud was quite clear that it was abuse, and you only have to read his letters to Wilhelm Fliess, where he describes in detail the horrors the children suffered, that he's in no way attempting to alleviate render treat lightly that experience. But the point about seduction is, two points I want to make is, one is what makes something seduction and not abuse or rape is that it the seducer seeks to awaken a desire in the person being seduced. and wants their consent, albeit a consent given under under the awakening of a desire, an intention by this on the part of the seducer. And this is very clear in the book, that a distinction is made of a class kind between the way these aristocratic vampires treat peasant girls, and they virtually pounce on and suck their lifeblood and finish them off within 48 hours. And various examples of that are given in the story. And this long courtship of Laura, the protagonist and narrator, by this apparently equally young lady, who turns out to be in fact hundreds of years old and is the Countess Mircala of Karnstein. She wants Laura's consent. She wants to win Laura over. So she embraces her and kisses her and strokes her, but she also gives her a line. She gives her a world view, which is signaled as being a secular modern worldview. And the late 18th century scientist who cited is Buffon. She cites the work of Buffon, who in the library in the Schloss, the castle in which they're staying. He was a naturalist, and he was one of the earliest naturalists who drew up a system of species to scientifically understand the different kinds of animals. And she has a kind of worldview we get a brief glimpse on, of which one could call an aggressive atheistic naturalism. And she hates religion, and when there's that funeral, the hymns that she hears as this funeral goes by drive her into a spasm of what the text calls hysteria. And she loathes hymn singing, she says. So there's a kind of allergic reaction to the supernatural. But she wants to seduce Laura, and to seduce her, it leads to the other meaning of the word seduction, which from the Latin, ducere, seducere, to lead somebody astray, to lead them onto another path, to turn them from one path onto another path. Okay, so its roots are in a sort of physical metaphor of leading somebody from one astray, from one path onto another, by awakening in them a desire and a consent. Okay, Laura, Carmilla could have just pounced on Laura, as she did on some of the other young women in the vicinity, but she doesn't want that. She wants Laura to consent to her dying, her erotic die. You will die into me, she says, and become like me. As in vampire legend or lore, the person who's vampirized becomes a vampire in turn. So she's wants to transform Laura into a version of herself. So that's the point I'd make about desire. Desire here comes from the other. Desire is awakened and provoked in the recipient by the other. And that's pretty obvious from the very hands-on, touchy-feely behaviour of Carmilla to Laura. She's always stroking her, touching her. Indeed, Laura is also does quite a bit of stroking in return. She talks a lot about Carmilla's wonderful hair and how she loved to tease it out and to spread it out. So she certainly does awaken a very strong desire that sometimes expresses itself in touch, other times expresses itself in a burning curiosity to know Carmilla's story and her background that have led to her mysterious appearance, being deposited by her mother after the coach is overturned outside the chateau or the Schloss. And she's been taken in. Camilla's been taken into Laura's household. She wants to know. She burns to know. She desires. The language describing curiosity as a passion. So her desire to know Carmilla is awakened by Carmilla's vampiric desire for her. But it's connected up by Le Fanu in a very interesting way to the question of the mother, the figure of the mother, of Laura's mother, of an early childhood experience, and of maternal legacy. Because it turns out that her mother, Laura's mother, whom she never knew, who died when she was in infancy, so she has no memories of her whatsoever, there's just a void or an absence. Her mother is a descendant of the Karnstein family, the same family of which Carmilla is a descendant of. So there's this affinity in terms of a maternal legacy, the same maternal legacy, between Laura and the vampire. Laura has a childhood memory, which she tells us about, which I'll just read a bit of. She calls it the first occurrence in my existence which produced a terrible impression on my mind and has never been effaced. So there she is in her nursery. She wakes up, she's 6 years old, and she fails to see the nursery maid. Neither was my nurse there, and I thought myself alone. I was not frightened, for I was one of those happy children studiously kept in ignorance of ghost stories and fairy tales. But I was vexed and insulted at finding myself, as I conceived it, neglected, and I began to whimper, preparatory to a hearty bout of roaring, when, to my surprise, I saw a solemn but very pretty face looking at me from the side of the bed. It was that of a young lady who was kneeling with her hands under the coverlet. I looked at her with a kind of pleased wonder and ceased whimpering. She caressed me with her hands and lay down beside me on the bed and drew me towards her smiling. I felt immediately delightfully soothed and fell asleep again. I was awakened by a sensation as if two needles ran into my breast very deep at the same moment, and I cried loudly. The lady started back with her eyes fixed on me and then slipped down upon the floor and, as I thought, hid herself under the bed. This time she howls, and the nursemaids and her various mother substitutes, her various governesses who are described as substitutes for her mother, appear and look around. They can find nobody in the room, but the place on the bed beside her is warm, and they whisper to each other, someone did lie here, the place is still warm. But the family line to the little girl is, it's all a dream, don't worry, nothing to be frightened of. This childhood memory is awoken by when she goes to visit Carmilla. She's not allowed to talk or interact with Carmilla because Carmilla's been apparently involved in the accident as the coach is overturned outside her house. And she's whisked upstairs to a bedroom, and then the doctor says, it's fine, you can visit her now. She goes up to visit Carmilla, this new young lady of about her own age, only to discover that she looks identically to the woman in her memory, that this is the young woman who had caressed her and joined her in bed and then was responsible for the two piercing needle-like sensations. And she exclaims with a kind of horror, barely controlled horror. And Carmilla does the same thing. She says, oh my goodness, when I was a small child in bed, this young lady appeared, and she caressed me and got into bed with me, and she looked exactly like you. Right? So Carmilla is very cunning. And every time Laura has an experience, Carmilla has the same experience and tells it back to her. Right? So this is reverse mirroring back to her, that I've had that exact experience and you are the other person. Okay, so she's very cunning like that. But it becomes clear that she exerts a power, a kind of magnetic, seductive power over Laura, who is both attracted and thrilled, but also repelled at the same time. And she says it's the ambiguity of this feeling that sort of paralyzed her. She has an intense fascination and even desire for this other young woman, and at the same time she wants to escape from it, and she's filled with a kind of repulsion and she can't act on. And the story takes us through carefully through various stages of this courtship, and as Laura develops in a psychologically quite intelligent and sophisticated way, an analysis of her own mixed feelings for this woman. At a certain point, Carmilla says, I'm going to have to go away, but but our relationship will continue in a strange way. I had the same experience you're going to have years ago, by a cruel love that hurt me here. And she taps her breast at the very point where Laura had felt the two piercing needles. And that night, Laura is a turning point. Laura has this experience of a presence in the room in the form of a cat, even though she keeps her door locked. And the black cat leaps up onto her bed and its eyes pierce into her. And she screams out and it vanishes away. But it's a sign that the courtship is turned into, as it were, the blood-sucking phase. And she then reflects on this experience and describes what the sensation was like. And I'll just read that out on page 282 of the Oxford edition. There was a remembrance of having been in a place very nearly dark, of having spoken to people whom I could not see, especially of one clear voice, of a female's, very deep, that spoke as if at a distance, slowly, and producing always the same sensation of indescribable solemnity and fear. Sometimes there came a sensation as if a hand were drawn softly along my cheek and neck. Sometimes it was as if warm lips kissed me, and longer and more lovingly than they reached my throat, and there the caress fixed itself. My heart beat faster, my breathing arose and fell rapidly and full drawn. A sobbing that rose into a sense of strangulation supervened and turned into a dreadful convulsion in which my senses left me and I became unconscious. Well, we have here something like a vampiric orgasm, something arising into a convulsion. And the voice here is not the voice associated with Carmilla. It's a deep voice, which is the voice of Carmilla's mother, who was with Carmilla in the carriage that overturned, and who beseeched Laura's father to look after her daughter while she, the mother, went on a hurried journey to which she would soon return. She was an elder woman with a very strong, solemn voice that has a magnetic effect on her father, who agrees to this outrageous proposal. So in a way, at this point, it's the figure of the vampire mother that's being evoked. And a couple of paragraphs later, this is sort of confirmed in reverse, where she says, one night, instead of the voice I was accustomed to hear, that is to say, the voice of the Countess, who is Carmilla's mother, I heard one, sweet and tender, and at the same time terrible, which said to me, your mother warns you to beware of the assassin. At the same time, a light unexpectedly sprang up in the room, and I saw Carmilla standing near the foot of my bed in her white nightdress, bathed from chin to feet in one great stain of blood. Now, I think we've got here the good mother and the bad mother. The good mother who steps in at the last minute to warn her daughter, her lost daughter, and reveals the presence of the blood-stained, blood-draining female vampire. This structure is taken directly from a poem by Coleridge called Christabel, in which there is a vampiric female outsider who's brought into the castle by the young heroine, they share a bed, at a certain point, her long-lost dead mother returns and warns her against this outsider woman. The word vampire isn't used, but she is she's a snake. She hisses. So I think Le Fanu has taken over this structure of three-way structure, really, of two maidens and a mother figure, who's split into two, between a predatory, blood-sucking, caressing, seductive mother figure and a mother figure who comes to warn and to protect. So you've got this polarized splitting of the mother figure, and it's in that context that the transmission and awakening of sexual desire in the hitherto innocent recipient is dramatized very clearly. And the mother figure here is associated with with a whole dynasty of mothers, as it were, going back to the mother to end all mothers, to quote Saddam Hussein, who is the original Countess Karnstein, you know, who has to be tracked down and a stake put through her heart and her head chopped off in order to kill the desire that she awakens in the other. So it's a story then about the transmission of desire from the from an ambiguous mother figure who is both desired and loathed, and who has the power to prey on the daughter recipient.